Blog Talk Radio.
Readers Entertainment Radio presents Booklights with your host, author Lisa Kessler. Booklights, where we're shining a light on good books.
Good morning, everyone. I am so sorry that it's tax day, but we are going to distract you with interesting stories about thriller books. So thank you for being here. And if you're listening live, welcome. And if you're listening later, welcome to you too. Today, you are in for a treat because we have Christopher Reich on, and he is a New York Times bestselling author of amazing thrillers, and he's got a new one out to tell us about. If you haven't read him yet, I'll read his bio so you can get to know him. Christopher Reich is the New York Times bestselling author of Rules of Deception, Numbered Account, and The Patriots Club, which won the International Thriller Writers Award for Best Novel in 2006. His new novel, Matterhorn, is available now, and you can learn more about him and all of his books. You can go binge reading. There are so many books, so it'll be really fun, and they're all on his website. I did put a link to his website right there on Blog Talk, so if you're listening live or if you're listening later, you can click that link and check out what he's been up to and sign up for newsletters and all that kind of thing. So definitely go check it out. And without any further delay, are you there, Christopher?
I am here, Lisa. Nice to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad you could be here today. Matterhorn is burning up the Amazon bestseller list. And can you tell everybody about what it is and why they should go grab it this week?
Well, sure. Thanks. I certainly will. This is my latest book. It's called Matterhorn. It's set, as the title suggests, in Switzerland primarily, but also across Europe. It's a big, globe-trotting, bomb-ticking, loyalty-blurring thriller, the kind that I've been writing for 15 years. You know, I say as a preface, I grew up reading the classics, Robert Ludlum, Frederick Forsyth, Tom Clancy. So if you like those kind of books, those are the kind of books that Christopher Reich writes. Now, Matterhorn, as I said, it's set in Europe, in Switzerland. It's the story of a retired CIA agent named Mac Decker, who's been in hiding in a small Alpine village for 8 years. He had to go away because he'd been betrayed by his closest friend, and his life and the life of his family was put at risk unless everyone believed with certainty that Mac was dead. Now, the book opens up on the steep face of the Matterhorn, an exchange of information between two spies, an American and a Russian. Things go poorly, and without giving away too much, one of them perishes. The one that perishes turns out to be Mac's son, Will. And his death brings Mac out of retirement, out of hiding, as Mac has to find out who was responsible for his son's death, and, of course, seek revenge in the meantime.
Ah, and I saw that this is Mac Decker book one. Does that mean he's going to stay, he's getting back in the spy business? Are you going to write more books?
Yes, he is back in the spy business, whether he likes it or not. It's kind of like The Godfather. They keep dragging him back in when he thinks he's out, you know.
Right.
But of course, I'm trying to build out the whole Mac Decker universe, which is absolutely so interesting. There have been so many changes recently in the whole kind of espionage ecosphere. It's at once more sophisticated and also more old-fashioned than it used to be, you know, with the use of the technology that's available. But also, there's so much technology that's very, very hard to hide these days, because
Right. Everyone
could spot your face and track you down. So it's fun working with all that and just, you know, seeing through Mac's eyes as he's brought back into the heart of the intelligence community, how he learns to use these new, incredibly powerful tools at his disposal.
That's cool. And do you find yourself, I hadn't really thought about that, but, you know, with Google face recognition and all that kind of stuff, do you have to make your spies use less tech so that, you know, anonymous can't hack into it and see what they've been up to?
That is exactly right. They do. And this is happening now where they're going back to the methods and procedures of the Cold War of putting a piece of chalk on a wall to set up a meeting of of using handwritten notes because everything is hackable. You send an email, you send even the most, you know, well-encrypted message is vulnerable these days. And so everyone's kind of trying to figure out how do we actually spy without getting caught.
Right. Yeah, they have to wear a fake nose and write a note with their left hand.
No, that's what's happening. And there's recently a really good book that came out about, written by a woman who was head of the of making disguises for the CIA for the last 30 years and making those kind of Mission Impossible faces, you know, where you see Tom Cruise reach down to his neck and pull off these masks. Well, apparently this happened. These masks were so good, so realistic, that face-to-face you could not tell that you were you know, being deceived. Isn't that – and it really is amazing. And so we will be using some of these. You know, with my books, I try to really keep it as realistic as possible. I don't try to go over the top and go into the realm of Mission Impossible and things like that, or the Fast and the Furious. This is about real people with real emotions, with real families who are doing the government's work and also and sometimes circumventing the government's work and doing just what's the best thing they can do to, in effect, save the world. Always a great personal consequence.
Right, right. The stakes are always real high, right?
When you write these books, the stakes have to be through the roof or else, you know, the reader's not going to be, you know, excited. And I think I always try to bring a real level of emotional intensity into my stories. This book, Matterhorn, I said, opens up with Mac discovering his son has been killed. I don't know any better reason to get back in the game or
right.
you know, motive for revenge than that, to look after, to avenge your son's murder. So, of course, this leads to Mac discovering a much larger conspiracy involved that is kind of drawn from the headlines. So, yeah, it's fun when you write these books because they really are a mix of what's going on today, which is the larger global picture, and what's always gone on inside the human heart, which is, you know, matters of love, passion, revenge, all those things.
Right. And when you're working on, when I was reading up about this book and talking about terrorism and all that kind of stuff, how do you research these things? Do you go talk to people who have been in the CIA or how do you do your book research for something like that?
Well, that's a good question. I'm lucky enough that I've been writing for a while, so I have developed kind of a network of contacts of people in law enforcement, in intelligence, all around the world, not just in the States, but in England with MI5, which is their equivalent of the FBI, in France, and of course also in the United States. So I'm able to draw upon these people to ask them, you know, what's going on today? Does this story make sense? For a few of my books, for my Rules of Deception series, I go each year to spend a few weeks with the New York Counterterror Bureau, which is made up of a number of three-letter agencies. You know, FBI, CIA, ATF, just to name a few, and just kind of embed with them and learn what they were doing. And in the process, really discovering the personalities that make up our law enforcement community and learning, you know, they're real people like you and me, you know, with sons
right.
and daughters and kids going to school and all their own personal kind of dramas playing out while they're, you know, trying to solve crimes or to prevent terrorist attacks, you know, very, very serious stuff.
Yeah. When you talk to these people and go, does this make sense? Have you ever had a big rewrite? Because I had a hero once that was a firefighter and I had already written the first three chapters of the book and there was this big fire and it happened to be on a cantina on a Navy base. And when I met with my fire captain, he goes, well, that could never happen because the Navy has its own fire inspectors and the sprinklers would have gone off. He said, unless you have an arsonist who turned off the water main. And I was like, what? And it changed the whole trajectory of the book because then we had an arsonist. But I had to rewrite the entire beginning of the book. Have you ever had a big rewrite like that after you interview and you're like, oh, no.
Not that bad, usually because First of all, good for you. I'm glad you actually rewrote it, because that nothing worse than tearing up pages once you've already, you know,
right.
Worked so hard
oh,
on
the
them.
Worst. Yeah.
But you can't make an egregious error like that.
Right.
Normally, I do my research before, so I kind of know what's going to happen, and I try to avoid that. Let me say this: I've made some other errors that are just as, you know, just as huge. Geography errors, putting an ocean in the wrong place.
Oh, no.
The wrong city in the wrong country, all kinds of things. And boy, I got some really scathing letters. Some readers are going, how could we trust you when you don't even know that the Indian Ocean is on, you know, the west coast of Pakistan? I said, oops, I missed that one.
Oh, dang it. And the editor didn't grab it either. That's funny, because there's so many eyeballs that go into a book, but every once in a while we all miss it.
Then there's so many eyeballs. So it's me, then it's my agent, then it's my editor, then it's the copy
right.
editor. Then there's another assistant. So you're talking about four or five very well-educated eyeballs.
Yeah.
That often miss the most egregious blooper of all time. And I just say it's their fault. I said, I didn't do it. You should have found it. That's your fault.
Right. It's their job.
I mean, they went to Yale. They went to Harvard. Come on. Get with it.
Right. I'm just a writer.
Exactly. When you turn in a book, you know, you're sending in anywhere between 400 and 600 pages usually, and there's a lot of room for error in there.
Yes.
And when you start reading, it's so easy to skip over an error inadvertently and keep on skipping over it. So these things
right.
happen.
They happen. Every once in a while, just all the eyeballs miss it. When you were talking about this book and the clock ticking, I was, of course, thinking of 24, because that had the anti-terrorism and the, you know, every episode had ka-chunk, ka-chunk. Do you hear that when you're writing your chapters? Do you have that clock ticking in the back of your head to keep that tension going?
Absolutely. First, I love that show. 24 was so
right. That was
awesome.
A great,
you know,
show.
Remember, it debuted right after 9/11, so the timing couldn't have been better or worse. Kind of, I mean, better for TV, worse for our country. But people
mm-hmm.
were really ready to watch a show about how we go track down terrorists who want to, you know, inflict harm on, you know, inside our borders. So
right.
No, when the whole point of my books is they're page turners, they're pedal to the metal adrenaline fest. So I'm always thinking of the, you know, the clock ticking, you know, the bad guy's always, you know, one step ahead, getting closer to doing something terrible. The good guy, you know, has to surmount incredible obstacles, both personal and professional. And, you know, everybody has to be after him. It just can't be the bad guy. Usually his own people are coming after him. Even his friends don't believe in him. And he has to persevere, you know, in this crusade to do what's right at all costs. So, yes, the clock is always, always ticking.
And did this book offer you any big surprises? Because I have friends who are big-time plotters, and even then, sometimes characters do something, and you're like, wait a minute, what? Did you have any surprises when you were writing this one?
No. You know, I always have surprises, because I write, at least I write longhand on a yellow legal pad.
Oh, my God.
That's where the magic happens. But whenever you start writing, and the fun of this is you never know, as you're creating a character or as
mm-hmm.
action is unfolding, what's going to all of a sudden come out of your head, something that you forgot about a long time ago, some experience you had, something you've read that you want to put in there. So, I mean, you do your best to steer in one direction, but oftentimes imagination or whimsy or whatever you call it will steer you in a different direction. And you just have to go with it. And that's where the books get good, because it's like, holy crap, I didn't think about that. You know, it's
right?
by sitting there doing the work. And, you know, whenever I have problems writing, my agent, he always says, Chris, stop complaining, just write. And
mm-hmm.
it always works out. The problems are always worked out. It's like, you know, in the movie Shakespeare in Love, my favorite movie, the guy's always asking, you know, everything's going wrong, and he goes, don't worry, it'll always turn out right in the end.
Right.
<it does. laughs>
Right. Well, I've always found that the books that took the biggest right turn, if I trust it, it always turns out better than what I thought I had planned, you know?
Exactly. And it forces you to be more creative. And I will say this, though. You asked if I made mistakes in terms of just, like, writing stuff that couldn't take place. I've made a lot of mistakes where my plotting goes wrong, where I send a character down a certain road, you know, figuratively, and all of a sudden 30 pages, I go, oh, this doesn't make sense. I better come back. You know,
right.
When I write my book, I outline my first act, which is the first 100 pages pretty much, and I kind of then know where the book's going to end. I know where the big explosive finale will be. And
right.
all my problems take place in then charting that course from page 100 to page 400. That's when all hell breaks
right.
loose. And I'll make all kinds
yes.
of mistakes and go forward and backwards, and it's never linear. It's always curving all over the place until finally, you know, the story makes sense.
I love that. Well, everybody who listens to this show, well, not everybody, but most people are readers, and they're really interested in, you know, how you became a writer. And, you know, was it twisty-turny? Were you doing something else and got a big story idea? What did your personal writing journey look like?
Well, I think mine is kind of, I don't know, maybe it's either typical or atypical, but I never earlier on in my life was dreaming about becoming an author. Never. I, you know, went to Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. Then I worked as a stockbroker. Then I got my MBA at the University of Texas. And then I went to work in Switzerland at the Union Bank of Switzerland. And I was just, you know, intent at all costs on, you know, making a lot of money and becoming successful in business.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was the era of the movie Wall Street, of Gordon Gekko, Greed is Good.
Right.
And I think I was consumed by that mentality, too. It's like, I'll just work, you know, 100 hours a week, you know,
mm-hmm.
until I'm a millionaire. So I didn't want to write at all. And I quickly discovered, working in Europe, that I wasn't the greatest financial mind ever. And while working at UBS, I was working in the mergers and acquisitions department, and I would be the guy that wrote these big, what's called deal memos, which are these big 400-page tomes talking about companies that are for sale or we're going to buy. And one day I got called in, Lisa, by the head of the Swiss bank, head of UBS, who's the closest thing to God as there is in Europe. They're just in Switzerland. They're just, I mean, they are feared and revered and respected. Anyway, calls me in. He goes, Mr. Reich, he goes, I just read this deal memo you wrote. And he goes, it's the first one that ever made me laugh. And he put his arm around me and he said, you are our own Michael Crichton.
Wow.
And, you know, the author of Jurassic Park and, you know, 100
right.
other great, you know, bestseller, Terminal Man, Andromeda Strain. And that always stuck with me. And so all of a sudden, flash forward 7 years or 6 years, I left banking. I was running a watch company in Switzerland. And for certain reasons, I decided to leave. And I just gotten married, and I said, you know, I don't want to do this corporate rat race anymore. I think I want to write books. And my new wife looked at me. She said, well, Chris, you never took an English class at Georgetown, did you? I said, no. She goes, you haven't secretly been writing short stories and stuff and hiding them in your drawer, have you? I said, no, but I just know I can write a thriller. I can write bestsellers. And she looked at me and she goes, you know, I think you can too. And so we left.
That's a good wife.
Yeah, it's a great wife. It was, you know, writing, you got to have confidence, and you have to have people that believe in you. So
yes,
we left
sure.
Switzerland, moved back to Austin, Texas, and, you know, I gave myself the chance to succeed. I had some money saved up, and I said, I'm going to write this book for a full year, and I'm going to do my best. I'm going to apply the same work ethic I had as an investment banker, get up, you know, be at work by 7:30, work till 5:30, and just write this book. And the first book I wrote was called Numbered Account. It came from my days in the super secret world of Swiss banking. You know, first draft, 660 pages. Someone read it. I took their advice. They gave me very good criticism. Be humble, reader and writers. You know, you have to listen to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was able to do the story. This is a good story. Through a family friend, I got the first 100 pages into the hands of none other than James Patterson.
What?
James Patterson, the biggest selling, I think, thriller writer in the world today. I mean, bar none.
Right.
And Jim actually read the pages, and he called me up, and he said, you know, Chris, I was really impressed by this. He goes, I usually never do this, but I'm going to recommend my agent to you. And he did. And the agent, Richard Pine, called me up, my agent to this day, and he said, this reminds me of those great Robert Ludlum books of the 70s and 80s. And he goes, you know, I'd really like to represent this book. So, of course,
wow.
I mean, I jumped up and down and said, yes, yes, yes. And so that's how I got started. You know, there's more to the story than that. But, you know, a year later, we sold the book to Delacorte, part of a Random House. And then a year after that, it came out and was an instant bestseller, and it's sold over 2 million copies since.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. That's amazing. You don't usually hear stories where right out of the gate, right, the bestseller. How hard was that for you to write the next book?
It was hard because I didn't – I thought I was – you know, it went to my head a lot because having that kind of success. I mean, it sold in like 23 countries around the world, so it was just giant.
Wow.
And then I thought, you know, I could write whatever I want to write. And instead of following that with another great financial thriller – because Numbered Account was really one of the best financial thrillers that had been around in a long time. I wrote a World War II book called The Runner, which got great reviews. It didn't do great in America. It only got to number 15 on the New York Times list, but it was a really big hit for me in England because the English love World War II stories. So this was – it sold a lot of paperbacks in England. But for book three, I went right back to writing financial thrillers, you know. And
there
I learned
go.
My lesson, and I'm an American writer, and I want to be successful in America. But since then, you know, I've started working with so many people in intelligence and law enforcement that my books kind of go all over the place. What they have in common is that they're exciting, they're interesting, peopled with real characters that you want to root for, and usually set in really interesting international, you know, settings.
Yeah, I was looking at, you have a couple other series, Jonathan Ransom and Simon Risk. Are they all CIA, or you want to tell us what those other two series are about?
Sure. My last series that's still kind of alive is my Simon Risk series. It's set in London. Simon Risk is an American who had a very difficult upbringing in Europe, kind of on the wrong side of the tracks. Now he's kind of restored his life, and he was working as a banker but then left. Because he has a very special skill set. He's able to kind of solve all these problems, let's say, that intelligence agencies can't be seen for themselves. So he's what you call a freelance spy.
He
does the work that the CIA and the MI6 can't be seen to doing. In his off time, he restores Ferraris. So he has his front is he has this great business restoring and selling Ferraris, which sell for a bloody fortune. And then, you know, on his off time, he goes and solves these thorny issues. And so that's a really fun series. And Jonathan Ransom is actually a doctor. He works with Doctors Without Borders. And in the first book, his wife disappears. And while he's searching for her, he discovers that she is not really the person who she said she was all these years. She's not the loyal assistant of his wife, that she's the one that's kind of involved in intelligence and draws him into that game. So I like to use this kind of Hitchcockian, like Alfred Hitchcock, ploy of taking unsuspecting individuals who are accomplished in their own right to begin with and then bring them into solving these thorny international problems and making them discover if they have the skills and the abilities to rise to the challenge and do what needs to be done.
Oh, I love that. Do you find, do you have like a secret dream to write a different genre, or are you totally in love with it's all thrillers all the time, or do you have like a secret sci-fi in the drawer, or is it, do thrillers just those are what you like to read?
No, that's a really great question. I think all writers definitely have dreams of writing other genres.
Right.
The first thing I'll say is once you have success in one genre, it's nearly impossible to break out of it. You know, you
right.
have to be writing. People, when they buy my books with my name on it, they expect, you know, an international thriller, you know,
right.
high stakes, fast paced. So I can't go and write, you know, a Danielle Steele romance.
Right.
Having said that, I've written several others that do take place in different milieus. And I'm working on one right now that takes place in Los Angeles on Sunset Boulevard in 1979. It kind of brings together a lot of the stuff that was going on back then, the big growth in the entertainment business, the rise of the celebrity chef, Wolfgang Puck. It's really set at the dawn or let's say the last gasp of the analog era, the last moments before there was iPhones, before there was the, you know, the Mac computer. It's the last moment when you could kind of do stuff and nobody would know about it. But
right.
I wanted to, it's a whodunit, but it's a social drama too, you know, about how so much has changed, you know, in our world in the last 40 or 50 years, the absolutely dramatic differences between how women are treated, how minorities are treated, how, I mean, the world has changed so dramatically, but set it in a fun, sexy backdrop of L.A. on Sunset Boulevard in Beverly Hills at that period. So, yeah, so your answer is yes, I would love to write different kinds of books. We'll see.
Yeah. Oh, good luck with that. It sounds fab. I love that there are – I've read a few books recently where they're like in the 80s before there was a cell phone, and it's wild to me now. I mean, I lived through the 80s, but it's wild to me now because I'm so used to my phone, you know, having the internet everywhere you go, all this kind of stuff, and to read a book where suddenly they're – the high tech is a pager.
Isn't that fun? I love it.
Yeah,
and that's
what
I want to accomplish with this book is to go back in time when there were pay phones, when you could, you know, you could walk around and people don't know where you are. They can't see where your phone is. It was such a more fun time in terms of, I mean, I grew up in L.A., so this is my life that I'm drawing upon. I grew up in that area, West L.A. in the 70s and 80s. It was so fun then. And like I say, you know, you could do stuff without being caught, without people looking over your shoulder. There was so much less accountability. And
right. People
didn't really treat each other that nicely. You know,
No. Men
certainly didn't treat women nicely. They were objectified and treated as second-class citizens. And it's just a fun world to explore, you know, in this realm of a whodunit. Set at the sexiest number one restaurant in L.A. In 1979.
Yeah, there was a documentary, I think on Netflix, that they were talking about the all the different serial killers in the 80s in New York, you know, Times Square area. And I had never thought about it, but they, you know, because there weren't cell phones and you couldn't tell, you know, who rented a room, and there wasn't, you know, all of these ways to track people. And it's scary. But also, you know, given how connected we are now, I would think as a thriller writer, that would be really fun stuff to work with, because you don't have to deal with all of those issues. Right.
Well, if you remember how they caught David Berkowitz, that's the son of Sam, who was killing people with, you know, blowing them away with his big pistol in the late 70s, and they caught him by parking tickets. They found the same car had been illegally parked at the site of like four or five murders, and that's how they knew. And so it was true old-fashioned, you know, just street
police
work.
They call
like,
yeah,
you know, police work, you know, the leather on your soles, you know, they tracked this guy down. And I mean, it was still miraculous that they got the guy, but yeah, so it's a fun world to write about, and yeah, it's great.
Ah, well, I already can't wait for your dream book, so keep me posted.
It certainly will. It's called Sunset 79. Great title.
Oh, it is. Okay, great. Okay. So we'll all keep our eye out for that. But in the meantime, everyone should go check out Matterhorn. And it's Mac Decker's first book, and there's going to be more, Our Unwilling Spy. Can't wait to read it. And if people get really excited about your books, how can they connect with you? We're just talking about not being connected, but how can they connect with you?
I'm all over. I'm on Facebook, Christopher Reich. You know, just put my name in Facebook, you'll find me, or on Instagram. Of course, I have a webpage, www.christopherreich.com. So, you know, I love hearing from readers. Always good to get their feedback. And hopefully, you know, I say, just give me the good reviews.
Right. If you love a book, always leave a review, because it definitely helps the author have the ability to that book and sink your teeth into it, and then leave it through when you're done.
Exactly. So, yeah. So, yeah. And of course, you know, you can buy the books on Amazon.com or where your favorite bookstore is. So, Matterhorn. I must say I loved writing it, and I would, you know, I can't totally guarantee, but I give you my word that you will enjoy this read.
Oh, I can't wait to read it. So thanks so much for being here, Christopher. It was great chatting with you, and good luck with this new series.
Thank you, Lisa. It was a pleasure. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us on Book Lights. Be sure to connect with us at www.readersentertainment.com for articles, blogs, videos, and podcasts that matter to readers.